Tonight's episode is our last episode for UFO month. And I figured what better way and what better treat for you guys for tolerating the first three stories than to have our UFO guy slash my UFO guy, Rob Christofferson, on the show, talk UFOs, talk his favorite UFO cases, and just some other fun stuff. So we had a really fun time recording. I will say it is completely unedited. There's a few swear words in there, nothing too excessive. Lastly, just a quick heads up that I'm going to take next week off. So our next episode of Pints and Puzzles will come out somewhere between February 9th and 10th. So without further ado, I'm going to do a live intro today.
What's a podcast? Find me a podcast. You're listening to my dad. My dad's show is the best.
All right, so tonight we have my UFO expert, I'm claiming you as mine, Rob Christofferson on the computer phone with us tonight. And, we're already a little exhausted because we've been talking already for about a good hour and 15 minutes because this is how Rob is just a wealth of knowledge as far as aliens and UFOs. And quite frankly, I was trying to figure out a case for the end of the month to kind of, all right, we've covered Travis, we've covered something more historical with the Battle of LA, and then tomorrow, hopefully, or sometime in the next couple of days, Cash Lundrum will come out, and then this will come out the week after. So I'm like, all right, we got to get something good to end UFO month with. And I'm like, all right, well, what would I do anyway? I'd probably Twitter DM Rob and say, hey, give me a good case to talk about. So I'm like, wait, instead of doing that, let's just have Rob come on and talk for himself. So welcome. So basically, yeah, it's me being lazy. I don't feel like writing, and I want to talk to you anyway. So it's a win-win. But just as a heads up for my listeners or anybody else who's listening, is that this will be fairly unedited unless we have any kind of bathroom breaks or technical issues. Otherwise, this will be unedited, so we'll put it up as is and go from there. There may be some swearing here and there, most likely from me, but you never know. Apparently that's what I do when I'm unscripted, is I just say a lot and I say fuck a lot. So that's just what it is.
Hey, it works.
If there's anybody who has better parenting skills than me who does not let their kids hear bad words, then you probably want to skip this episode or at least put headphones on. So
I think you're like 95% of the parents out in this country.
Yeah, they use it in the right context. I mean...
That's important. Teach them right.
Exactly. And don't say it around mommy. Those are the two rules. You know? So anyway, welcome, Rob. And
Thanks, man.
Do you want to give everybody a little bit of background on you, kind of where you are, if you have anything new, are you, you know?
So, yeah, I am apparently the unofficial go-to guy for everybody that has a UFO case that they want to cover. They will ask me questions about UFO case and, like, any general theories about that. I don't really know how I got to be that guy. I just became that guy. I am a member of the ARC over at Astonishing Legends. That's kind of how most of this started, and then it snowballed from there because I got to know Chris Cogswell, Marie Mayhew, and a lot of good people over in the ARC, and they did their podcast, and then they led me to other podcasts, like the yep. Not Alone podcast, and I'm good friends with Sam over there, and we do the Lowdown over on the Mad Scientist podcast, where we review...
Which is hilarious.
Yes, where we have fun ripping apart the low files, because it is as zany as it's made out to be. So,
which, honestly, even if you've never watched the low files, which I haven't, you don't need to. It's hilarious just hearing you guys talk and the different personalities. Like, if you guys want to get to know your podcasters behind the scenes, check out the Lowdown file. And I think that's over on a Mad Scientist podcast feed, so check that out.
Yeah,
they're always funny.
There's a couple episodes, and like, yeah, we have fun because it's like, oh, hey, there's Chris. He's going to explain it to you. And then there's me. I'm the guy on the other side of the aisle. You got Sam. He believes in a lot of stuff, but listen, he's going to show you a hug on the way in and out.
Yep.
And
And what about Marie?
Marie is fantastic because, like, she could be funny and she can pose that scientific side at the same time. So, like, she plays opposite of Sam, which is fantastic.
And she plays off like she doesn't know the science side, but she really does. Like,
yeah, you know, she's really smart. And, like, if you talk to her about Robert Bigelow, you will be involved in a 5-hour conversation that goes down multiple rabbit holes. And, like, there's no way you can find your way out.
There's pretty much no way you can find your way off any Skinwalker conversation, which is why there's, let me see. So Not Alone did 3 hours at least of it. Astonishing Legends did what, 10 hours? Or so on Skinwalker, I feel like.
Yeah, it was. It felt that long. I think it's like 5 hours, somewhere close to that.
Yeah, and Pleasing Terrors did a shorter kind of overview of it. They did a nice little twist on it, too, which was good if you want the condensed version of Skinwalker.
Yeah, I kind of want Mike Brown to, like, narrate, like, my... I want him to, you know, be at my funeral to speak my eulogy and everything. Like, they would be perfect. Because, like...
I agree. He's such a good storyteller.
He is. He's an amazing storyteller. And I'm like, we were in his Facebook group that he has for Pleasing Terrors. And, like, he shared this post about, like, these supposed, I forget what they're called, but they're, like, these creatures that are, like, 30 foot long that, like, supposedly swim in the Arctic. And they look kind of anthropomorphic and stuff like that. And, like, I was like, hey, Mike, like... that thing looks like it needs a hug. I think I'm going to go be that guy that gives that thing a hug. And then he sends me like he sends me a GIF that's just like, nope, nope, nope. And I'm like, Mike, if I died hugging that creature, would you tell my story? And he's like, some stories are never meant to be told.
That's perfect.
Yeah, so perfect.
So mine, but I think actually you kind of answered the next question I was going to ask you, which is how you got started or how you became the UFO guy. But I think it's really because a lot of those podcasts you mentioned, like Not Alone, Mad Scientist, and Pints and Puzzles, are all basically bastard children of Astonishing Legends. You know, like, so that, I think that's how you became the UFO guy. You know,
it could be. It could very well be. Like, those guys have inspired more than you know. A few podcasts at this point. If you want to go back to the true origin story, because, like, this stuff goes back to, like, my childhood, not even talking about my experiences, but, like, I have grown up with my first love was the Ghostbusters. And, like, it wasn't even just the films. Like, when I was growing up, we had the real Ghostbusters cartoon. And I watched the hell out of that all, you know, all the time. And, like, I was...
Which, by the way, is still on Amazon, I think. I was watched... Or, no, it's on Netflix. Yeah. My kids watch it all the time. They love it.
It is so fantastic. And the greatest thing about that cartoon series is, like, they looked at ghosts as if they came from another dimension, which was so great.
So you want to know something funny, which I don't think I've ever shared this, but I will with you because you brought it up. Do you remember the Boogeyman episode?
Yeah. Yeah,
I will still close my closet doors to this day because of that. Because I watched that episode when I was a kid, I will still close my closet doors and make sure all the closet doors are closed.
That boogeyman was freaky because it, like, had a huge head. I'm like, what? Yeah. What? Like, realistically, I'm like, there's no way the boogeyman can support that head on that small a body.
Seriously. But, yeah, that was great. And it's funny because there was, I think, 5 back-to-back, which is so different watching it on Netflix now. Because I'm like, this is what was on the VHS that we watched over and over again. That could hold, like, what, 4 half-hour-long episodes or something?
Yeah.
And it's like, these 4 were on that VHS that we, because I remember them all, you know, very vividly. Because my brothers and I must have watched them over and over again. So
yeah, those were amazing.
But that's funny that was kind of piqued your interest in there originally when you were younger.
Yeah, and then it spiraled into of course Unsolved Mysteries, because, like, my theory was Robert Stack was, like, a ghost the whole time he was hosting that show, because he was so damn creepy every time. I'm like, dude, you gotta be dead. Like, the way that you're talking, the way that you look, the way that they, like, the cinematographer shoots you, you look dead. You're talking, and, like, you throw in that theme song where, like, something's going to happen. Something's going down. I know it's going to happen because that theme song indicates that something's going to happen.
But imagine how great of a podcast that would be now, though, with his voice and all that music.
Oh, yeah. You know? Oh, my God. That would be the number one podcast out there.
I agree.
Yeah. But for me, the ones that, you know, the stuff that they covered on there that stuck with me was always the unexplained stuff. And it, they didn't cover it every episode. Most of the episodes were missing people, murders, and, like, more murders. But, like, there were two cases that stuck with me that, like, I remember, like, the first time I saw them and, like, how vivid even today thinking about them. One is the Allagash abductions, just because, like, the drawings that those guys produced were so creepy. Those things looked so insect-like, and everything is like, oh, no. And so I've put that one out of my head as much as I can, but
you don't want to look into that one any further.
Nope. We're not going there. We're closing that door on that one. But the other one that has always stuck with me is Lonnie Zamora's case, because it is so unique and strange and just, like, mind-boggling that even, like, Project Blue Book was baffled at what exactly Lonnie Zamora witnessed. So
tell us about that, about, like, give everybody kind of a high level overview, because I know I have my listeners are split with, like, most of them probably won't know what you're talking about, and then some will be like your level, where it's like they know too much of what you're talking about. So for those that don't know what you're talking about, tell us a little bit about that, kind of the high level overview of that case, and also why it stuck with you. Like, why is that your, when I say your Travis Walton case, you know, like, mine was Travis Walton, Cogs's was Betty and Barney Hill. And it's just funny that we all have kind of our alien cases, so to speak, that stuck with us since we were kids, you know?
Yeah. Lonnie Zamora, he was a police officer with the Socorro, New Mexico Police Department. And this encounter took place in April 24th of 1964 at approximately 5:45 p.m. So Lonnie Zamora, he's chasing a car just south of town. He's trying to just chase that speeder down, and all of a sudden he hears what he describes as a roaring sound, and he breaks off the chase, and because there's a nearby dynamite shack, and he thinks, like, oh, hey, that this thing could be exploding. I better get over there. Not the first thing that I'm going to do if I hear a roar and I think of a dynamite shack. Oh, go towards the loud sound. Yeah, that's smart. Okay, so, yeah, Lonnie Zamora, he approaches it, and he sees in the sky, it's descending, it's this bluish-orange flame, and it keeps descending. He keeps hearing this roar, so he's approaching where it's coming down in the desert. He gets close to it, and he could see that on the ground, he perceives it as like a car crash, like some car is overturned in the desert, and there's like people trying to push it over. As he gets closer, what he sees is that, no, what this thing looks like is an oval shaped craft, and it's got, you know, landing gear down, and he can see two what he describes as either small adults or like really tall children, he can see them outside the craft. They're like gathering like soil samples or something like that, and then all of a sudden one of them looks over and sees that Lonnie Zamora is standing there, and they're like, okay, we're done, we're getting out of here, so better get it back on the ship. So in the time that Lonnie Zamora exit his vehicle, because he conveniently drops the mic to his radio, he picks it back up, puts it on the thing, and by the time that it's back on there, the alien beings are back in the spaceship, and he seems to hear that roar again, and he sees the flame. It starts, the craft starts ascending, and he takes cover behind a hill, but the craft ascends to about 10 to 15 feet in the air, and then it goes silent, and it moves off in a direction away from him. It passes over this supposed dynamite shack, like, barely. It made it by about 3 feet, according to Lonnie Zamora, and it just keeps coasting on away from him. And he radios into the dispatcher, asking him to look out the window to see if he could see this craft, and they can't see anything. And the first person on the scene is Sergeant Chavez, and he arrives, and he can see that Lonnie Zamora is shook up. He's pale. He asks him what happened, and he tells him the story, and they go over to look at the landing site, and they notice that there's a burnt bush. There's a couple burnt bushes, and there's impressions left in the ground where Lonnie Zamora saw the landing gear of the craft. Now, what's fascinating about this case is that there was actually an FBI agent in town investigating something else, and they got wind of this, and like they aided in the investigation. They ended up getting a hold of like the generals at the, because like the White Sands missile testing site is actually not that far away from Socorro, New Mexico. And they basically get back to him and say it isn't anything that we, you know, launched out in the desert or anything like that. So the government sends out Blue Book, Project Blue Book. So J. Allen Hynek comes out, the director, Hector Quintanilla comes out. Hector thinks that it's not alien or anything like that. He believes that it's like something that we have the technology to do, and he thinks like it may be like a lunar lander or something like that. And but the problem is that he can't prove it. There's nothing that he can he has come up with to prove it. But
now, did Blue Book have access to like stuff that the general public wouldn't know about, you know what I mean? Like the high level classified ships and that sort of stuff. They wouldn't have known about that, right?
I don't think so, because like the thing about Project Blue Book is like they were very kind of public at the same time that they were doing all this stuff. So like I don't think they would have access to all that kind of stuff. So you know,
so it could have been something that he didn't know about.
Yeah, it could have been. J. Allen Hynek, he wrote about this case in his book, it's called the Hynek UFO Report, and he begins, he classifies this as a CE3, a close encounter of the third kind, which is basically a close encounter where you can see humanoids. That's right. That's the basic thing, and this is a quote from him to where he begins in his book. He says, "For this next case, I was sent by Blue Book to Socorro, New Mexico, and as an official investigator. Despite my strong desire to find a natural explanation for the sighting, I was still unconvinced about the reality of CE3s." And like, I kind of find that funny because he's the guy that coined it. But yeah. But he goes on and says, "I could find none. The case is therefore listed in the Blue Book files as unidentified." So he gets Lonnie Zamora's statement, and like if you really want to read Lonnie Zamora's statement, I highly, you know, recommend that you pick up the Hynek UFO Report. You can get it on Kindle. I don't think they have it in print anymore. It's been out of print for years, but they started putting his books back out as the ebooks, so you can go read that. But Hynek goes and investigates the landing marks is what he calls them, to see if he could find a natural explanation, like if it was like cattle in the area or whatever. And what right. he says, the marks were 2 to 3 inches deep, sandy, clayed, and hard packed, and they appeared to be scooped out as though a heavy mechanical device had slid rather gently into position. So,
So it sounds very similar to the lunar lander.
Yeah, it very well could be like a lunar lander or something like that. But it's still classified as unidentified. in the Blue Book files. Not that, like, you know, they've opened them back up or anything, but they never solved it. They didn't. They don't know what it is.
And for perspective, how many unsolved in the Blue Book files?
There
wasn't that many, right?
No, I want to say you of all the files, because they all the cases that they investigated was a ton. I want to say is probably under 50 at least.
Yeah. So Blue Book was the government's kind of way of looking at UFOs during the UFO time frame, right? Just for people that aren't aware. Right, if I remember right, it was it funded by the Air Force officially?
Yeah,
I can't remember.
Yeah, but it started out as Project Sign back in the late 40s, and then it changed names to Project Grudge. That's when J. Allen Hynek comes on, and after that, it becomes Project Blue Book, and it was about a 25-year-long investigation.
Now, do you think that they did legitimate investigations, or was it more just appease the public with, yeah, we're looking into this weird stuff that's happening?
There was an aspect to them where they seemed to be debunking stuff, or at least trying to, because part of the reason why J. Allen Hynek kind of turned tail in the way that he approached these investigations is because he ended up doing a press conference, and I can't remember what case it was, but he presented to the audience that what had happened is that it was swamp gas. He put the term out there, swamp gas, and he got ridiculed tremendously for that. And it was because of that. It's really because of,
so it's all his fault.
Yeah, pretty much. That swamp gas stuff, it's all J. Allen Hynek. And he kind of turned it around, and he started to believe in this stuff more and more. Like,
I think it was that part that had me convinced to a degree that it was like they're telling him to debunk some of this, or like, oh, just say it was swamp gas because we don't actually know. And then he knew that they didn't know, and then he's like, oh, wait. If they're telling me to say it's swamp gas, and I know it wasn't swamp gas,
yeah,
then now I'm starting to believe something's happening that can't be explained.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, exactly. And that's where, and after that, Hynek founds the Center for UFO Studies, or QFOS, which is no longer, investigating. They did release his files to a guy. I can't remember his name, but there's a biography written about him that came out this year. I haven't had a chance to read yet, but I've heard a lot of great things about it.
Yeah, he is. He's definitely one of the pillars, I guess, in the UFO community, so to speak, or definitely in investigating UFOs.
Yeah, he's definitely like the guy that brought.
He coined all the close encounter stuff.
Yeah,
so.
he was the guy that definitely gave it some legitimacy, along with guys like J. Allen Hynek and John Keel and Bud Hopkins. Those four guys to me are like the pillars of ufology. The four, on Mount Rushmore, those are the heads.
Who's the fourth one? So we had Hynek, Keel, and
you had Hynek, Jacques Vallée, Keel, and Bud Hopkins.
Oh, there we go. Okay, I knew. I thought I was missing one in there. No Philip Klass, really. No, I know you and I share views on him.
Oh yes.
Wait, wasn't he part of Blue Book though? At some point
he may have been. I don't know, but he's an interesting character. He's he's the personal attack guy. He's the kind of guy that you use swear words for, frequently. Yep.
Yeah, I have. Yeah. You should have heard the stuff that didn't make it to the Travis Walton episode. Anyway, so what was it about? So other than it sounds like there was some veracity behind the people looking into this particular case, as far as, obviously just because he's in law enforcement doesn't mean necessarily that he's not human, right? So he's still a human, still fallible in that regard, but people are more likely to believe law enforcement based on their training and their, you know, he's less likely maybe to misidentify certain things. And then you had the FBI involved and the fact that Project Blue Book even looked at it and then couldn't figure out what it was. Is that kind of what's kept it in your mind for so long?
Yeah, because I can't discount any of it. Like, it could, there's always that small chance that this is this could be like some government experiment of some kind that, you know, Lonnie Zamora just, you know, happened to get in the middle of. But like, one of the things that kind of really, you know, keeps it open in my back mind is like the humanoids he described seeing were short. They weren't like normal sized people, like as we look at people. So to me,
kind of like what people think of as the grays.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. The
like that height.
Yeah, they were short. They were like about, you know, 4 feet tall.
Sorry. Yeah, the short grays, not the tall gray. I forgot. There's two kinds.
There's a few kinds. Yes, but yeah, that's definitely kept that open in my mind, you know, all these years.
I find it interesting that it was close to the missile base too. I feel like ever since we started screwing around with nukes that they started test like sending the little grays over to see what we're doing, you know?
Yeah, no,
I feel like
absolutely.
There's a connection there.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. Also for me, what has really kept this in my head too is a personal experience I had a couple years ago. I was outside on a break with a friend, with a coworker, and, you know, just shooting the shit. He was smoking a cigarette and all that stuff. And it's a nice, warm June day, and I look up in the air, and I see this object in the air. And it's not particularly very high, but it's spherical shaped. It looks really like a flying egg because it's an off-white color. It has no windows on it and or anything like that. And it's moving really slowly parallel to where I am. And it gets to exactly, you know, pretty close to where we are standing. And then all of a sudden it just stops in midair and it turns and it moves away from us. So that's another reason why Lonnie Zamora's case is stuck with me, because I kind of experienced something similar in terms of the type of craft that he has seen.
Hmm. Yeah, that's interesting that it was similar motion too, right? That
yeah.
He was describing when it kind of flew away.
Yeah, because like there's definitely a ballistic aspect to the craft.
Non-ballistic motion, right?
Yeah. There's that ballistic aspect of, oh, we're still burning fuel to get in the air, but like once we get into the air, you can't hear the thing. It's silent. And it's, you know, moving off in a slow direction.
Yeah, maybe just their technology can't deal with the takeoff aspect from Earth, you know? Like,
no, it's got issues. It's definitely got issues.
Too strong of a magnetic field or something. I don't know. Let's get
yeah, maybe. I don't know. I mean, that's a question for Cogswell, and I have a feeling that if you know, he even looked at this case, he's going to go off on that ballistic motion happening right there.
Yeah. Well, that was the first thing when I was thinking about it too. When you mentioned you were going to talk about it, I was like, wait, yeah. So why are they using fire? You know, like, aren't they beyond that if they can get here? You know,
yeah, right.
So that was me playing Cogswell for a minute, but like you said, there's too many elements. If you put that little bit aside. Okay, what else is going on, you know, that would confuse you? And there's definitely a lot there that doesn't fit with anything terrestrial that we knew about, at least.
Yeah, at that time in 1964, because, you know, we're a few years away from the Apollo program. So, yeah.
Or were we?
Or did we even land on the moon?
You're not going to get that kind of conspiracy from me. You won't get any argument with that moon landing from me. But it is interesting, the ones that kind of stick with you forever. So, yeah, actually, because you mentioned it, and I know a little bit from listening to you in previous interviews as well as conversations, but what other weird shit, for lack of a better term, have you experienced other than that? That you want to talk about? That's kind of UFO related. How about that? We'll narrow it down.
Okay. when I was a teenager, and this was around the time when my sister moved out of the house, I had moved into her room because it was a little bit bigger, and where we ended up putting my bed was right by the windows, and it was three windows together, and there was one night, it was, I want to say it was like in the winter sometime, I was going to sleep, and I was having trouble falling asleep, and all of a sudden I look out the window and I can see this one is like an orangish light in the sky, and it, what it would do is it would blink on and then it would blink off, and then it would appear in another location. It would blink on, blink off, and it would keep doing this, and it did this for about a minute before I was just like, oh, that's kind of cool. I'm going to go to bed. No, don't look at that anymore. Just go to bed. Cool. Awesome. So it's like maybe a couple weeks later, and we're watching, like, it's like a rerun of Unsolved Mysteries, because their seasons were so, like, almost seem like so distant, mm-hmm. you know, between when they would show new episodes, and like they were re-airing the Allagash abduction episode, and when they showed the pictures of that they'd drawn of the Greys, I started freaking out. I didn't freak out, but I just felt like deep panic, and like I had to leave the room. So like, yeah, that was kind of weird, and you know, that may, you know, feed into your theory that I've been abducted, but
I wasn't gonna say unless you brought it up, but I mean, you see some weird stuff, I don't know, you get freaked out by Greys. I mean, they are freaky looking, especially when you're a kid. That sticks with you for a while, you know, like especially the Hollywood version of them from back then too. So
yeah, and like those eyes, man, like,
yeah.
Those eyes stick with you. They don't leave. Like, they're like burned into your subconscious, even, you know. So,
but for the record, you're not convinced you were abducted then?
No, because I've never had, like, I don't have any of the telltale symptoms of someone who has been abducted. I don't have any PTSD like symptoms like most abductees come away with. That I've never had bad dreams that, you know, indicate that or anything like that. And like, I've never had like weird marks on my body or anything like that. So I'm not fully convinced. I think it's just, you know, coincidence. So you saw this object in the sky. Oh, hey, there's this episode where people who see objects in the sky, sometimes they get taken up into UFOs. Oh man. Maybe that happened to you. No, stop freaking out. You're freaking out right now. Stop it.
You do never know, though, right? I mean, you know, I find it interesting that you had a couple of these odd things, maybe nothing directly, but a couple odd things happen here and there, and then you end up being the UFO guy later on, you know?
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's a spiraling thing. They want me to talk about them. I don't know why.
I guess there must be the good ones, then, that want you to talk about them a little bit.
Yeah, maybe they want the press, you know, I don't know. It's like, maybe if I write an article about them, one will show up in my room and they'll be happy with the coverage that I gave them. I don't know, you know, anything's possible at this point.
So if you had to list your top three, let's say, to narrow it down, believable, let's say, UFO, let's go with abductions. Let's start there. Cases that people could either have covered or could talk about. What would you say? People can Google.
The first one you've already covered is Travis Walton. He, to me, he's the most convincing. It's the most convincing case because you have multiple eyewitnesses. You have the fact that he could recall all this without hypnosis. It just leads me to believe, and like the way that he presents his story every time, he's one of the most genuine people I think you could ever meet. Like when he was on the Low Files, he was he's that guy that shows up in a suit, and he's, you know, really intelligent, and he tells his story, you know, and he's believable. So that would be my number one.
Something different watching him too, right? Like I always say for people that are like, oh, I'm not sure about Travis, I'm like, just watch a YouTube video of him talking about it. It's something, there's something different with his face that's I don't know. He doesn't have the crazy eyes or something. I don't know. It's something, just something that's very believable about it. And I freely admit to being biased on that case, but just go watch a YouTube video if you're still not sure, you know? That's what I always recommend to people.
Yeah, no, definitely. The second case I bring up is Linda Courtial's case, and it's unique because the way that Bud Hopkins documented her case, there were numerous eyewitnesses that actually saw her being abducted out of her New York City apartment. And one of the people that supposedly witnessed this is one high-ranking member of the United Nations. So to me, that's convincing. I know a lot of people aren't convinced otherwise of her case, but I always have been.
Now, hers was, she was abducted from her apartment window, and wasn't she famous too, or am I mixing my cases up?
She was kind of famous, but I mean, Linda Courtial's not a real name. Oh, so right. she's been on, using a pseudonym for like 20 years, but it was a pretty well-known case, back in the day.
That's what I thought, yeah. So then what's your third?
My third, and even after, Cogswell covered it on the podcast, Betty and Barney Hill, to me, is always going to be kind of a convincing case. Yeah, there are certain...
Really?
Yeah, there are certain aspects of their case that, to me, show signs of this. It's like, yeah, they had two different experiences, and their accounts are slightly varied. But even for people that are part of the NAACP, that are coming up in the civil rights era, these are people that are active in that community. If it is something to do with that type of experience, where this is racially motivated or something like that, I don't think that they would make up an abduction story to hide that. I really don't.
Oh, that's an interesting perspective, that they would have just said, hey, these cops harassed us or whatever, if that's what, that's the one theory, right? For some reason, I never bought into Betty and Barney Hill. And I don't know why. It just never was one that I always just wrote it off as, okay, whatever. I don't really buy into it as much. So I never really researched it a lot. So it wasn't until Chris started doing his series on it that I actually started reading about it again. And you're right. There's some definitely weird things in there. I personally don't buy it, but that's just me. I don't know why. It just never clicked with me for whatever reason.
Right. And it's like, if you can go from their case and explain, like, if this experience is something like a screen memory for something traumatic that they've gone through in their past, that's perfectly fine. If psychologists can explain it like that to me, I'm fine with that. So far, psychology doesn't look at it seriously enough to come to any conclusion like that. The only people that were really looking at it that were serious was Dr. John Mack. And Dr. John Mack, he passed away in 2004. I think he was kind of on the precipice of, really making, breaking ground in that and maybe coming up with a theory as to exactly why. But I also haven't read his book, Abduction. He's written a couple of them, but I just haven't had the time to read his books. But to me, we haven't made that, we haven't broken ground enough with that phenomenon to explain it away completely, because it's still happening. That's the only thing. And I'm sure there's plenty of people that are hoaxing it. Stan Romanek hoaxing it all day long. But
Billy Meyer.
Oh, Billy Meyer. he's so terrible. It's like, dude,
he's not even trying.
he's not even trying. And it's like, oh, hey, we found the models, man. We saw you, how you did it. No, they're still coming to see me. They let me take pictures of them. Shut up, Billy. Shut up.
But it's a shame because, like you said, there are real I don't know, at least people believe, real people that believe they were abducted, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
Out there that definitely feel like they've had something happen that you're really not sure about. And these crackpots like Billy Meyer give them a bad reputation, you know?
Yeah, and like the thing about all of this is like you can look at other types of phenomena and like where they cross different spectrums. Like when you talk about like sleep paralysis, mm-hmm. you can divide sleep paralysis into a number of different type of activity that you experience. It is either the hag herself that you see, it is shadow people, it is the abduction experience, I want to say there's another one I'm forgetting. It'll come to me at some point.
For the record, like, we don't talk about shadow people on Pints and Puzzles. Yeah.
Oh, no, you don't?
No. I'm just kidding. I'm like, I will never cover shadow people.
you don't want to talk about the Hat Man?
I record in my basement at night usually, I don't talk about shadow people.
I got you. It's cool, man. You're gonna be okay. You're gonna get through this.
Yeah,
TJ, you're gonna get through this. Don't worry, I'll help you.
I'll be under the desk, just talking into my microphone until somebody comes and gets me.
we're gonna be okay. We're gonna be okay. But like, that's the thing. It's like you could divide this phenomena into these type of experiences, and also when you look at Dr. Rick Strassman's experiments with DMT back in the 90s. He was mm-hmm. the only person that has ever gotten the government-approved test to do tests on human subjects with DMT. And for those that don't know, DMT, it's your body produces small amounts of it, but like if you ingest it in the right amount of way, you know, the right ways, you can smoke it, you can inject it into your veins and stuff like that, you will hallucinate. Like, you'll have intense hallucinations.
My exposure to that has been Joe Rogan, because he's obviously a big proponent of the DMT.
Joe Rogan's
pretty much across the board.
Joe Rogan's another discussion for another time, because I have sour opinions of Joe Rogan. But
I used to until I started listening to his podcast, then I'm like, I could buy into him a little bit more on something.
A little bit, but my problem is that Joe Rogan acts like he has a monopoly on the truth, and he doesn't. And like that kind of bugs me.
We got to take a little tangent, that his Alex Jones episode was fucking hilarious.
Like, it was funny, I will give you that.
I enjoyed that, and I don't think Alex is as crazy as people want to believe sometimes. He's batshit crazy, but I don't think he's 100%, just like 95%.
Just 95, yeah, which is enough to not be taken seriously, so that's fine. The episode that he had when he had Graham Hancock come on and debate Michael Shermer, that was actually a pretty good episode, because there were times like Shermer didn't sound like he knew what he was talking about, because he hadn't really adequately researched the topic. But like, other than that, generally sour opinions on Joe Rogan. But
that's all right. We promote indie podcasts anyway on this show, so it's all right.
And who the hell has time for a 3 to 6 hour podcast like every day? Get your shit together, Rogan. Jesus. But
we may have to bleep some of that out.
that's fine. That's fine. So Rick Strassman, he gathers together these group of patients. He starts with his friends, and he starts, trying to find the right dosage of DMT to give to these people. And eventually he gets it right, and these people have one of three experiences. There is like the abduction experience. There's the experience where they claim to be talking to almost a godlike figure or something like mm-hmm. that. And like there is like almost the Mother Ayahuasca kind of thing, where like you meet this person who is giving you advice and telling you to change your ways to, you know, make your life better. So like,
like the Oracle, Oracle type of thing.
Yeah. Something like that. So like, given, these different experiences, they are archetypal. Why are they so archetypal like that? That's a question I want answered, and I don't think that there's
one of the theories that we have the DMT in our pituitary or somewhere hidden in our brain that kind of gets activated when we die, and that's where we see like the afterlife stuff. Isn't there a theory around that?
Yeah, that's right. The fourth experience,
their brain gets flooded or whatever.
Yeah, they have an NDE kind of experience. Yeah, that is one theory that I can totally believe. I can totally buy that.
Not comfortable for a lot of people to buy into, but.
But still, it's just it to me. It's like, why is sleep paralysis archetypal?
Right.
Why does it happen that way? And like, I'm sure somebody can try to explain it to me, but I don't know if they can fully explain it to me.
Yeah, and you wonder why some of that, like you said, has been around for as long as it has. Like even the gray aliens. I mean, they were around forever. You know, you can go back ancient aliens type of stuff where they have the cave paintings or whatever of the things that look kind of like grays, you know?
Yeah, and like the first person to even think of like those type of beings is H.G. Wells. H.G. Wells writes this. It's kind of like a satire. I've never read it because like it's hard to get a hold of like digitally, but it's called, I believe, Man of the Year Year Million. And he basically, presupposes that the future of humanity, they look exactly like grays. No joke. And this is like, I want to say late 1800s, early 1900s, somewhere around there.
Okay. So that's kind of what we evolve into later on.
Yeah, that's what he's, you know, that's interesting. And that's the thing. It's like satire. It's a joke. But like, why that?
Or is it?
Yeah, or is it? No, I don't know.
That's what we're going to call this episode. Or is it?
Or is it? Yes, absolutely.
What do you think are like the biggest misconceptions with the UFO? You being kind of the UFO expert, what do you think the biggest misconceptions that like the general kind of non-tinfoil hat wearing people have about the whole UFO concept or abduction theories, that sort of thing?
I think like there are a lot of people that, and J. Allen Hynek was one of them that put the idea out there that 95% of at least 95% of UFO sightings and experiences can be explained away as misidentification. And I think part of the problem with the UFO community is like we're so quick to jump to UFOs, but we never talk about the IFOs, the unidentified flying objects. I think that needs to be stressed a little more. I also feel like at this point in ufology, we're getting to the point where we're spinning our wheels. Like we're struggling to find new ways and new approaches to do things, and we haven't totally found that. I think there are certain people that are, you know, coming up with different ways and different ways of interpreting things. Like there's a really great book called The Messengers by Mike Cleland, and he talks about like screen memories and owls and stuff like that, but putting
fucking
the
owls
right, those damn owls. But putting the theory out there that owls do not represent screen memories in the sense that you're trying to cover something up. What they're there for is to remind you that something important happened. So
that's interesting.
Yeah, it's always been an interesting theory put forth, and like there are people advocating that we need to go back to the people, like really get close to the people and you know, suss out these eyewitness accounts and put them under a microscope, because like we're getting UFO reports daily. Like there are Twitter accounts you could follow that like repost UFO sightings from like MUFON and stuff like that, and they'll tell you exactly what these people, you know, witnessed and stuff like that. And like,
I feel like you're not hearing as much about like the abduction type of stuff, though. Maybe it's just my Twitter circles that I follow. But you like, yeah, you like you said, you hear a lot of the, oh, we saw weird lights, or we saw the, you know, the I don't know if triangle shapes may be getting out of vogue now, but you know, like you start hearing a lot of those UFO kind of type one sightings, I guess it would be, where it's more weird stuff in the skies, but you don't hear as much about abductions or interactions with aliens of some sort, you know.
Well, I think at this point, like, the serious researchers that were researching that are dead now. Like, Bud Hopkins is dead. John Mack is gone. Like, these serious investigators aren't here. So I think the ones that are here that are investigating it, and, like, I'm not gonna do a hit job here, but there are certain people in MUFON that look at this and like they're not put under enough scrutinized lens. And
you think people are just getting bored with it, or getting lazy with it, or both, or
I think both.
Something different.
I think both, because I think in the process we lost the scientific method in applying it to these cases. It's just, hey, we saw something that's interesting, and we're going to tell people about it. That's it. Like, where's the?
Yeah, it's almost like the social media and stuff makes it too easy to share stuff without thinking about what it may or may not be. You know?
Yeah, like.
Like you said, it's so easy to tweet something and just be like, oh, I just saw this weird light outside. And then people are like, okay, cool. Next tweet, you know.
Like, I was recently on an episode of the Double Density podcast. We talked about Men in Black and stuff like that. And it was fun. And we joke about, Tom DeLonge, his big thing is like he's going to bring UFO disclosure to the people. And he makes a big announcement last week where he's founded the To the Stars Academy of Arts and Sciences. Great. Fantastic. And he's saying that we're going to build spaceships powered by lasers. Okay. Okay, sure. Sure, Tom. Sure. And he's got information. He's going to bring us disclosure. Oh, yeah, did you know we need to publicly fund this? We don't have the money for it. Well, no shit, Tom. You can't build a rocket. You don't have enough money to build a rocket because, like, you merchandise the hell out of To the Stars. And, like, yeah. I swear to God, if you look at their social media feeds, they are posting new, like, merch and all that stuff. And I'm like, I'm not meaning to bash on Tom, because like he's passionate about this, you can tell. But like, there's a way to go about this, and if you're saying that you want to bring about disclosure, you don't do that by also having an initial public offering of your company. It doesn't work like that.
You think there ever will be disclosure? No. Public disclosure? No. I don't think so either.
No, it's just there's. To me, it seems like with our government, there's too much to lose by doing that. If you believe like that our government has, you know, like crashed saucers and that we've, you know, reverse engineered them and stuff like that, if you want to believe that. Also, it could be that the government has nothing, but nobody wants to believe that. Why would anybody want to believe that? That's not fun. But,
well, and also, like, then how, what are they going to use to cover up? Like, you know, Roswell may have been a top-secret weather balloon, or it may have been a real thing, depending on which side you see it on. But either way, if it was a top-secret project, it took the alien aspect, took a whole, you know, took the distraction off the top-secretness. You know what I mean? I'm saying that completely wrong, but I think the concept is at least coming out where it's a good distraction from other stuff that they may not want you to be looking at.
Yeah, and like after Roswell, how many people know about any other crashes that ever happened? Nobody knows anything. Nobody talks about anything. Like, we know that
there's the one 3 days after Roswell too in New Mexico, right?
Yeah, well, there's that. There's the Aztec crash in 1948. Yep. If you believe the priest, who talked about the Cape Girardeau crash in 41 that he, you know, delivered last rites to alien bodies. There's another one which predates the Roswell crash. There's and you covered the Aurora, Texas crash in 1897.
Yeah.
Kecksburg, which, you know, the jury's still kind of out on that one. It's tough to say what it is. I'm not totally on board with the Mark II, but and it's only because, like, there were
I think that's what I ultimately came to on my on episode 4 of ours, the Mark II. But I don't know. There's still a big part of me that buys into the Nazi Bell thing too.
Yeah, because I mean it you know, eyewitnesses claim that this thing made a controlled maneuver before it crashed. It's supposed to crash, so it's like, I don't think the Mark II could do that. To me, it couldn't. But, you know, I could be totally wrong. It's not like they haven't declassified documents about the Mark II, to be honest. Like, do we even know what the Mark II looks like?
There was the one picture that you see on when you YouTube it, but that's about, or when you Google it, but that's about it.
Yeah. Like, we don't totally know exactly. I
mean, but they could have put anything out there and said that was the Mark, you know, like, isn't there allegedly a Mark II in the Smithsonian or whatever?
Yeah, I've heard something about that before, but
or a version of it, I think.
Yeah, but that's the one thing I think that's holding me back is, like, we don't totally know about the Mark II.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of other weird stuff, I think, but I think to the average person who hasn't dug into a lot of this stuff, that, you know, it's like, oh wait, Roswell and maybe some other stuff here and there. Some people may have heard of Betty and Barney Hill. You know, that's kind of the next level after Roswell, and then Travis would probably be the level after that. And then you kind of get into more closer to our territory, where you just start digging into too much that you can't even remember which case is which after a while.
Yeah, and then you get into that place where people are asking you, like, oh, hey, what do you think about this case? I'm like, why am I an authority on this? Okay, sure, I'll tell you what I think. No problem.
I wasn't actually going to go here until you just brought it up. Was, what about, I don't know if you ever catch Nighttime Podcast, but he's done the Shag Harbor one, which I love, mm-hmm. because it's a USO.
Yes.
And there aren't a lot of USO cases out there.
No, that's the most famous USO case, because, like, there are, you know, off of California and in the Great Lakes, they talk about people seeing, you know, craft flying into the water. But the thing about the Shag Harbor thing, and, like, I haven't seen this angle covered, you know, that often before, but supposedly the, you know, U.S. Navy tracked a USO for about a week that made its way up into Shag Harbor, and then they had the theory that it was malfunctioning, and that the UFO sighting that happened at Shag Harbor, where it ended up going into the water, it was there to help it, because there was also other eyewitnesses that claimed that they saw both these ships rise out of the water and fly off.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I haven't heard that angle before. Yeah. I always thought it was, I think it was when we were talking about the Mark II, like, because that was a satellite, you know, top secret satellite. There was the thing that it was the, whatever the predecessors for the keyhole satellites were.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's, you know, they were dropping their film canisters down, and that's what the Shag Harbor was. There's definitely a good argument on that. But now you put another twist into the case.
Right.
I always feel like, though, there's got to be some, and I've always thought this in my head, is like, everybody's all focused on outer space when there's so much of the ocean that has not been explored yet, as far as the depth and the areas, that there's got to be just as much weird shit in the ocean as there is in outer space, you know? And that's where I've always been fascinated by USOs, you know?
Yeah.
And that side of things.
Yeah, absolutely. I can concede that. And, you know, the ocean is...
But there's not a lot of great cases about it, which is the other weird thing. It's like, either they're not documenting them, or they just don't get as much press as the UFO side.
Yeah. And, like, the problem is like, when you have guys like Jimmy Church putting out there that there's an underwater alien base off the coast of Malibu, because they took a look at this Google Earth image and they think, oh my God, look at that thing. It's almost a perfect oval shape. Hey, look at that. It's got really weird pillars and really weird places. There's an alien base right there. I'm like, that's a really poorly constructed alien base if I ever saw one.
Seriously. And they made it obvious enough that we could find it, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like, they'll never have, like, satellite imaging ever.
Yeah, exactly. what was it? The Lake Baikal. That's what made me think of that, too. It was kind of USO related too.
Yeah, the swimmers, man, those are freaky. Like the way that they've described them, and like, oh hey, they can make you leave the water. They can make your body just fly up and out of the water. Oh God, that's terrifying. But like, yeah, they're like 7 feet tall. They don't.
I'll refer to people to Astonishing Legends on that one as well, because that was a great episode.
Yeah,
that was one of my favorites of theirs.
Yeah, because like Lake Baikal is like as strange and as terrifying as the ocean itself. I mean,
if not more so. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they got freshwater seals, man. That ain't right.
Yeah. That, well, again, once you start mixing the Russians into the whole mix, it gets really questionable on multiple levels.
Well, it's like I live about 2 hours away from Lake Champlain, which is where, you know, America's most famous lake monster champ lives, supposedly. And they talk about, like, oh, it could be all these strange things like sturgeon and stuff like that. And, like, that's totally fine. The freakiest stuff that is in that lake is... there are eels in that lake, and there are also lampreys. Lampreys are terrifying. Like, they have the lamprey problem isn't as bad as it used to be, but holy God, you couldn't put your boat in that freaking lake without coming out with at least two or three stuck to your boat.
Wait, what's a lamprey?
A lamprey is like...
I'm not even familiar with them.
It's how do I explain it? It's kind of it has like a similar composition to like an eel, but it's really small, and it has like a really round mouth, and it's like sticks to like fish and stuff like that.
Oh yeah, okay, all right. So Google that or don't.
Yeah, or don't, because you'll be terrified. And like that's the thing, like.
Those things are freakier than any alien.
Yeah, like the guy from River Monsters went to Lake Champlain, and he's like talking about like, I'm looking for this monster that and he just keeps describing it, and I'm like, dude, it's a lamprey. And like, anybody can tell you that. Stop trying to play up this mystery aspect. It's a lamprey.
Well, apparently you can make lamprey pie, apparently.
I don't even want to think about that, you know?
Apparently you could eat them.
Okay. I'm never going to...
Go figure.
I'm never going to do that, but listen, if you want to do like an episode of Bizarre Foods, man, you know, you could totally do that.
That'd be great. That sounds like something a lot more... I think, didn't Rumor Flies do that or something where they did something along those lines?
I think,
lines,
yeah, but. I think so.
I will hold on a second, bend over and pick up all the names we've dropped on this episode alone.
Yeah, I know. I know. It's like, I think we should expect a kickback here or something, you know.
So the only name we haven't dropped yet is Our Strange Skies, which I would, as we're kind of wrapping up here, why don't you talk a little bit about that?
So for a while, I've had an idea to do a podcast, and like I've been trying to, you know, come up with a concept in my head, and like, I'm like, UFOs. I'm the UFO guy, so much so that I changed my Twitter handle to Your UFO Guy, because I'm your UFO guy. I'm everybody's UFO guy. So I started putting the idea out there. I was like, I want to do a podcast. I'm like, people, help me name my podcast. And then like the other names that I was throwing around were like terrible, like really, really bad names. And like, the good one that I had was Our Strange Skies. I'm like, oh, that's got a ring to it. And like OSS, like that's even creepier.
Yeah.
So, came up with the name, and I'm like, okay, what am I going to cover? I'm like, Our Strange Skies. What's so strange about our skies? It's like, oh, we got a pretty rich UFO history. Like, so rich. Like, I know it so well. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to talk about mostly America's UFO history and with events and myths and all that stuff going back into the colonial era, because there are some interesting cases that, you know, occur before America was even a country and up until now. I've always been fascinated, kind of like with the Jacques Vallée angle of the folklore and how things, the UFO myth and legend, has changed over time. So, Our Strange Skies, it's if I plan this out right, the first episode is going to drop January 8th, 2018. And
there you go. You've heard it here first.
And we're going to be looking at some early cases early on, and then we're going to get really in depth into the Roswell crash, because like there are new and interesting theories. And I think people gloss over it a lot because a lot of people have done it to death, or a lot of people are just pessimistic about it to begin with. Like, let's name drop another one, although it doesn't even matter. But last podcast on the left, I remember listening to their episodes about it, and they were just like, oh, this is nothing. They almost seemed like bothered that they were doing an episode about it. But that really is the springboard for America's kind of UFO identity. It comes from that case, and like, it comes...
Yeah, because if you tell just the average person that has no interest in this field, like, all right, name something UFO, or say like, oh, I'm doing a case on UFOs, they're gonna be like, oh, Roswell. Like, that's the only thing that people, or usually the first thing that people come up with, you
yeah
know?
And like when you talk about other countries' big UFO events, they're always like, that country's Roswell. It's like, mm-hmm. Well, do you know Roswell as well as you think you do? Because maybe you don't. And like the theories that Nick Redfern has, you know, looked into with regarding Roswell is pretty interesting, and there are going to be other ones that I'm going to look at, like those idiots Schmidt and Carey, who were totally down with that alien body a couple of years ago. That
yeah,
that,
the slides.
Yeah, and then I'm like, how do you not know that's in a museum? Like.
Yeah,
like you could look at it like there's glass, and you could see that woman's legs reflecting off of glass, and I'm like, that's in a museum. What the hell are you doing? But like, we're gonna look at a lot of cases that people know, and a lot that people don't, and I'm getting excited for that, you know. And it's gonna be a
I think we're all excited too, and it's kind of a good balance of history, a little bit of strange UFO stuff, but not. It sounds like you're not going too far into tinfoil hat territory. So, people that are more interested in the history side definitely could buy into the podcast. That sounds like.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, I watch.
Like, you don't have to be a tinfoil hat guy like
that.
No, us.
Like, I watch the Dark Files on the History Channel, and like, I'm not even sure if the tinfoil hat works anymore. I'm not sure if I need something a little more foolproof and like thick metal here.
I actually had this my podcast closet. The moving blankets are actually lead. You know, those lead blankets from the. The dentist's office, you know, that's actually what
I like that. You should make every phone call in your house from that and from that room.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. It's like it gets hot enough in here with under the stairs with just the moving blankets. I can't even imagine. I'd be passed out in 5 seconds and not from the beer. be like, what happened to TJ? He died.
He died, but he was happy while he was doing it.
But he was protected from the aliens.
It was probably a government agent that got him, really.
So actually, I'll put your promo in here too at the end after we hang up here, just so people can get another feel for it. How about that?
Yeah. You know what the most brilliant thing about that promo is?
What's that?
Is that I quote a Canadian and then I say we're only doing American stuff.
All right. Nobody caught it unless you said it. So.
Well, I mean, like, I do say that he's the former Canadian Minister of Defense. So it's like, oh, hey, like, Did you guys realize that I quoted a Canadian and then said I'm doing an American podcast?
But it is interesting that the Canadians and the Mexican government seem a little bit more willing to talk about it than the American government.
I think a lot of governments are like the Belgian government when the Belgian wave was happening and they were seeing these black triangles and people were claiming it was our government. Well, maybe it could have been.
Maybe. And maybe that's why they're so quiet about it. I don't know. I think it's a control thing, but that's just, that was, spoiler alert, but that was one of Travis's theories too, was he doesn't think disclosure will ever happen because then people will be, instead of being all patriotic towards America, it'll be patriotic towards the world because there's this, as Reagan said, you know, like the greater threat towards humanity as a whole now. So now we all have to like each other as a human race, not as just Americans, you know?
Well, yeah, we can't be united. Like, then you know what happens? The reptilian agenda gets exposed, and then we gotta look David Icke in the eye and say, you were right. God damn it.
If that ever happens, I hope I'm really dead by that point.
Like, I will
put that on the record now.
I hope that one of those reptilian bastards gets to me because, you know, I can't live with myself knowing that David Icke was right. At least in human form, I can't.
I don't think any of us could at that point.
No, and like,
Didn't you just post on Twitter that you had
hour long DVD and I'm like, I'm going on vacation soon. I'm going to watch this. And if I die, just know that it's a just death from watching this.
Somebody needs to pay you to do that.
The thing is like, I don't remember buying it and I don't know why I own it.
I think that's scary in and of itself, right?
Yeah, I think like...
See, the mind control's real.
Yeah, it clearly is. I mean, like, I you never know. Like, I could be a Manchurian candidate and I don't even know it.
Well, on that, it looks like we're hitting about, I guess, the hour and then... Whatever the first part of the recording was before it broke.
Yeah, the first part of the recording that they don't want you to know about.
Right. We were talking about some stuff, and then we just heard beeping, and I don't know, it shut off. But anyway, before we wrap up, how can people find you and tell them how awesome you are on Twitter?
You could find me on Twitter. My personal account is at your UFO guy, YER UFO guy. I have a Twitter account for the Our Strange Skies podcast. It's at Our Strange Skies podcast. And it also has a Facebook page, facebook.com/ Our Strange Skies.
All right. And you guys are not allowed to ask him any questions because that's saved for us. we need you at full working capacity for our podcast.
When I mean your UFO guy, I mean you better have a damn podcast and you better be shouting out my name every time.
Seriously, you better. I think most of us do, actually.
I've seen my influence. I've seen the range of my influence on people because they asked me for my theories and I'm like, oh, they're putting forth that. Yes.
I know, really, you could just be a government agent trying to tell us all the wrong stuff the whole time.
I'm not Richard Doty. Stop it.
On that note, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk with us, and more so thank you for not having me write a last episode. I think this is actually a good way of ending UFO month. Definitely, I want everybody to check out Our Strange Skies. Check out all of Rob's stuff. I mean, your Twitter account's funny regardless of the UFO stuff. It's always funny.
I try to keep it funny. I definitely try to keep it funny. And like, folks, they tell me I should write a book, and I'm going to tell you here, my first book, when it comes out, the title will be The UFO Agenda. Have you bothered asking them yet?
All right, quote us on that. You know, that's officially on the airways now, on iTunes, or it will be.
Yeah. Yes.
And so that's officially copyrighted now, guys.
Yeah, it's mine. You can't have it. I'm sorry.
I want people to check out your low files, too, plugging Chris a little bit. But also, you guys are just hilarious on that as well. I always said that we should all do a podcast, which is basically the Low Files and me, of us just all drinking and bullshitting like this. Because, I mean, think about it, we do kind of all separate episodes anyway with us bullshitting. We should all just get together and do it like once a month anyway. And I don't even care if anybody actually listens to it or not. I feel like we should just do it just for fun.
Oh, absolutely. It would be the theories that would come out of this would be so amazing. Like the ufology experts and the experts in the field, they would be begging for us to work with them.
Only when we're drinking, though. We're only smart when we're drinking.
Well, absolutely. You know, the rider comes with alcohol on it. So, yeah, absolutely.
What was that story you did about that? Because that's what made me think of it, too, was your fictional story you did, quote unquote fictional story.
What the hell is that called? Oh, it's called Dreamland in Winter.
Yeah, that was funny. With the fake bar and all of us in there. That was great.
With the fake bar, yes. If you want to go find that out there, it's on the XCast blog.
There you go.
Just Google the XCast blog, and this project is called It Came From the Sky. And if you read my story, Dreamland in Winter, there is a scene in it with a bunch of people you may recognize from a bunch of different podcasts all in this bar. Scott and Forrest from Astonishing Legends are in it, and Scott is talking with Chris Cogswell about non-ballistic motion. Marie Mayhew is sitting at a table with Forrest denying his existence.
He doesn't exist.
You are at no, he doesn't exist. You are at another table, sweet talking people out of money with your voice.
I made you put that in there.
Yes. Yes, you did. And Sam is at the bar. He's the bartender. And Jason's at the end of the bar with a mullet, but he really ties that bar in together. Yeah.
I thought that was great and not too far inaccurate, actually. So I don't know. The best part of that was how much thought you put into the drinks alone. So we'll just let people go and read it. But it was very accurate if you know any of us. So.
Oh, yeah. No, it definitely was, because I started asking all you guys for drink recommendations. And that was that was the most amazing Twitter exchange I've ever seen. I would agree
with that. And it wasn't we came up with our own. We came up with each other. So that was the best part.
Yeah, absolutely.
And poor Scott. It was in Forrest. They're sitting there. You know, they have like the big podcast, so they're busy. They're sitting there like, what the fuck? So many notifications.
Yeah, right? They're just like, yeah. And I forget what episode that they were covering at the time, but they ended up bringing it up because I had shared that David Foster Wallace, this is a water speech. I'm like, oh wow, like at least that conversation had some influence on that damn podcast.
Exactly. You've had more influence than people are allowed to know. All right, Rob,
yeah, right,
thank you so much, have a good night.
Yeah, thanks, man.
It was Paul Hellyer, the former Canadian Minister of Defense, that said, UFOs are as real as airplanes flying overhead. And here at the Our Strange Skies podcast, we're going to take that seriously. Starting in January, we'll be looking into UFO events, incidents, and myths that make up our American identity, from the pre-Roswell era to the post-Roswell era. We'll be covering some of the lesser-known incidents, like the Aztec UFO crash of 1948, John Everill's colonial UFO encounter, and Robert Richardson's 1967 brush with the Men in Black. We'll also be covering some of the more well-known incidents, like the Roswell crash, and doing in-depth profiles on people like J. Allen Hynek, Sergeant Clifford Stone, and many more. Look out for the Our Strange Skies podcast in January. In the meantime, don't forget to look up, because you never know what you'll find in Our Strange Skies. In Gray, we trust.